Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Jonathan Blank about his newest documentary, Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. It's about the nation of Holland, a country that does a lot of things pretty well. You can learn more at jonathanblank.com. Jonathan Blank, one word, just as it sounds, .com. Let me remind you that after a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic, Google Play, and about anywhere you can find podcasts these days. And at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally.net. A quick plug for participation, which I've also been doing since Trump's Electoral College victory. Here's a few websites and organizations that I think are doing a really good job of mobilizing people and standing up for, you know, what needs to happen. Indivisible.us, Indivisible, one word, of course, .us, and that is a group that emerged soon after that election in 2016 and has at least 5,000 local groups. You get an email every week giving you four or five things to do that week. A couple of organizations that were primarily digital for years but have coordinated over the last few years much more with grassroots. On the national level, moveon.org. That's moveon, one word, .org. And in California, Courage Campaign, one word, .org. And then two that are very specific, fivecalls.org. That's the number five and the word calls. And that tells you some timely and relevant calls you can make to your representatives, and townhallproject.com. One word, townhallproject. That tells you when your representatives are going to be holding meetings in your area where you can go and meet with them face-to-face. And then since climate change is certainly in the news and in the future, and in the present, 350.org, probably the largest global organization organizing to confront climate change. Okay, to today's show. I spent a few days in Amsterdam in 2008, and the word I found myself saying over and over to describe the country and the people was civilized. So much of how they do things just makes sense. I mean, what do you say about a country whose national symbol is a form of renewable energy? I mean, come on. But beyond the windmills, the cannabis coffee shops, and the red light district, the economy in the Netherlands is one of the best in the world. They're in the top five of almost every quality of life index, and they're number one for work-life balance. Dutch kids are ranked happiest in the world with their parents close behind at number five. The Netherlands healthcare system is ranked third in the world, and the government runs a budget surplus. How do they do it? What can we learn from them? Or, as some will claim, is it ridiculous to compare Holland with the U.S.? I mean, apples and oranges. And aren't they having trouble with the anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant right-wingers? If, like me, it drives you crazy that Americans so proudly ignore learning anything from any other country, Jonathan Blank's new documentary, Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles, will be infuriating. Blank is a filmmaker, writer, high-tech entrepreneur, and martial artist. He is CEO of Reading Kingdom, an online reading teaching platform. His books include Secrets of Dragon Gate, Ancient Taoist Practices for Health, Wealth, and the Art of Sexual Yoga, and Still as a Mountain, Powerful as Thunder. And among Jonathan's films as writer, producer, and director are Sex, Drugs, and Democracy, Anarchy TV, Collecting America, and his newest, the one we're talking about today, Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. Welcome, Jonathan Blank, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Hey, Terrence, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Very welcome. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, October 1st. So, as I think you know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. I'm not, as I often say, I'm not interviewing a book or a movie, but a human being. Can you talk briefly about your path? I mean, just in that brief bio, there's a lot of tangents there, about your path to the work you find yourself doing today, and so that people get a sense for you, feel free to go way back. Mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Well, I think it all started in kindergarten, Terrence.
You wouldn't be the first to go that far back, by the way.
I think I've been very fortunate to grow up in a family that encouraged a lot of questioning and challenging existing notions of the way things are and the way things should be. Both my parents were academics, professors at university level, and from the earliest age, I have always been interested in ideas like freedom and democracy and exploring consciousness and so on. And so I started making films. I went to film school and I made a short that was at a lot of festivals. It was called Karma Express, and it was exploring Buddhism. And I, for a long time, I was studying and practicing Buddhism. But I always had I've always had a big challenge with the concept of karma, and I don't accept any philosophy as complete unto itself. And I think you have to avoid dogma. So that was about a teacher who's teaching about karma, and he doesn't believe in karma. But then he kills a fly, and a bus comes through the building and runs him over, and so he gets
that
instant
was your short.
Karma. That was my short, yeah, and. My next project was called Collecting America, and that was about ostensibly about baseball cards that sell for $1 million. But it was really about what I saw as the main problem in the United States, which is that the value that we place on everything is the monetary value and not all the other things that are valuable in life, everything from happiness, to social welfare, to a clean environment, to seeing your kids grow up healthy and happy and strong. And
not that we ignore those things, but they have to get in line behind money.
I think a lot of people ignore them almost entirely. And I think even as time has gone on, it's gotten worse. And that film has a lot of people talking about how when they were kids, they would trade cards. And you didn't care if the corners got bent. And now kids get cards and they put them in plastic immediately and they put them away, which is ridiculous because, of course, most won't ever amount to anything. And then there are a few super rare cards that actually sell for $1 million. But it was a lament in a way, done in a comedic fashion, about America's obsession with money. And after I did that, I decided, I want to make a movie that's more about a place that's doing things right. And so this was the 90s, and we were still, as we are now, still very heavily embroiled in the war on drugs and the whole moral majority, the rise of the Gingrich Congress, and the prosecution of a president for a blowjob and that kind of thing. And so I went to Holland, which at that time was insanely liberal by American standards with, the legalized cannabis and the legalized prostitution. And just, at the time, the world had 5 million Greenpeace members, and 1 million of them lived in Holland.
With a population now of 17 million.
Yeah, so back then it was 15 million.
So one out of 15 was in Greenpeace.
Yeah. And they, down the line, they were just really liberal. Now, they had some issues, and some reviewers actually said, you didn't look at the negative things. And I said, I understand that. But to me, what was shocking was to interview some black activists, and they would say Holland's the best country in the world. And so to me, I could have gone, and if I'd pressed them, they could have said, yeah, Holland has this problem and this problem and this problem. But I was interested in it, and there were gay people in the movie going, this is a gay paradise. That was before gay marriage was legalized in America. So it was shocking to me the extent of how liberal it was. Now, since that time, 9/11 happened, and 9/11 really, I think, changed the world in a very negative way, and it became this way of right-wing people polarizing populations based on the hatred of Muslims and immigrants.
Let me cut in for a second.
Yeah.
I was surprised. I suppose I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised when it comes up in the movie that, oh, things changed after 9/11. There had been suicide bombers in the Mideast for years. There'd been suicide bombers in Northern Ireland and so on. And yet 9/11 was we know it, what it did here, but it was a significant culture change in Europe and the Netherlands as well.
Worldwide, it's been used. And the arguments that were then created by the Bush administration about why they had to take away people's rights, why they had to go to war, all based on lies or misrepresentations or outright propaganda, have been utilized by groups everywhere. And just as you see now, people around the world using Trump's lies and propaganda in the same way. America is truly an example to the rest of the world, and in good ways too. A lot of Dutch policies are based on studies that were done in the United States. We've come up with a lot of great things here over history, or over our history, but we have also had a very profoundly negative influence on the world, and 9/11 is one of those. So after 9/11, and then there were a couple of very high-profile murders of Dutch people by Muslim immigrants, and that, of course, fed into it. But the idea that then saw the rise of this right-wing politician named Geert Wilders, who's frequently known as the Dutch Trump, but that's not really accurate because he's not insane, and he's not stupid. And so, another thing that's very important to note is right wing in the Netherlands and in the rest of Europe does not mean opposition to the welfare state. It almost exclusively means hatred of immigrants.
Right. I knew we'd get into this at some point. We're right here at the start. But yeah. One of the things that struck me was that right wing, I mean, it was almost like, well, what's left to be right wing about if they don't have the religious hangups. So they're not necessarily against gays or against sex or any of that. And they're happy with the welfare state, the health care, the vacations.
Yes, and in fact, one of their big arguments is that, for instance, with regard to the welfare state, is immigrants are going to come in and use your health care, and they haven't paid into it for generations the way you have. And when it comes to gay rights, they align with gay people who feel like these Muslims are much more anti-gay than the general population, which is true. They are. They come from a totally different society. They are not integrated, and it takes time. The enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of.
Right. It's a wonderful triangulation, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and it works.
One of the things, by the way, that I was thinking was at one point, again, as I'm watching the film, I hear someone say, well, we've had 20 years of right-wing governments.
That's right.
And yet, the welfare state,
the
sex, drugs, and so on doesn't seem to have changed. So it really does indicate a deep difference with the United States.
It is. Right wing in Holland does not mean what right wing means here. Right wing in Holland is essentially being more pro-business than the left wing, in favor of lower taxes than the left wing, but still much higher than here.
Enough that still could supply their health care and their vacations
top,
and all
yeah,
that.
Their top tax rate is 52%.
Right.
You know, and I think it was just dropped to 51% maybe.
And it strikes me, I can remember, the U.S. has in its golden age of the 50s had up to 91%, but that was at the super top. It seems to me this 52% is not just the 1%. The people who pay 52% is a broader
It is, but it's also progressive. So if you're at the bottom, you're paying a lower rate.
And, I say of course.
But, and the people in that bracket are only paying that on the income above the threshold level. So it's all progressive taxation. And the people there are not protesting the taxes. So the rich people, there's a sense of solidarity in the population.
So even when you have right-wingers courting people based on, it's got to be based on fear, because it almost always is, but that fear doesn't really take hold the way it does here.
Well, the reason they've had right-wing governments is because they're developed this small but very vocal and influential minority that was anti-immigrant. And then you had all your left-wing parties that generally can't agree on things because left-wing people question things more, they debate more, and they have a harder time being unilateral. And so the right wing could slip in there and go, we're going to be anti-immigrant at an acceptable level. And not crazy racist, but not, we're going to hold up traditional Dutch values, but we're also going to uphold, you know, those traditional Dutch values of tolerance and openness at the same time. And they became this kind of middle way that could siphon off enough of the right-wing votes and enough of the left-wing votes to form a government in a multi-party parliamentary system. And it's actually works reasonably well in Holland, let's say, compared to a country like Israel, where you see tiny religious parties with incredible influence.
Leverage.
Yeah. And they don't have that in the Netherlands. But the left-wing parties have not been able to deal with, you know, the significant 20% of the people who are still supporting this crazy anti-immigrant position. And you know, the Netherlands has some significant challenges. They're the smallest, most densely populated. They're the most densely populated in country in Europe, not smallest geographically, but among the smallest geographically. And there is very limited housing. There's a housing shortage, which has been a
homeless problem.
No homeless problem. But I was shocked spending all this time there. And there are homeless people, but I didn't see them. And for the most part, homeless people are people who are actually choosing to live on the street because they do have options for being off the street. And there are many social services available. You know, there's nobody's dying on the streets the way they are here in Los Angeles. I forgot the recent number I read, but it's horrifying. The number of people who are dying, the homeless who are dying here in Los Angeles.
I don't know that.
Yeah,
number,
it's terrible.
Well, if you got 58,000 people homeless.
That's right. Yeah. And you're not, your social services for them are terrible.
Right.
And I mean, we're seeing the rise of bubonic plague,
right,
you know, and things like that here. And we're not, you know, and Angelenos are good people. You know, this is a very liberal place. And I believe it was they voted to raise their taxes $4 billion to help pay for this problem. And I think the problem is so big that it needs help on a national level. And of course, we're not going to get that kind of help. And the people in charge here are not competent enough to deal with this. And so it's not being dealt with the way it should. But, you know, when we have more than 10% of the nation's homeless people in this city, it's not fair for us to have to deal with this. Just like it's not fair for states that are on the border to have to deal with the whole border problem by themselves.
Mm-hmm,
you know, this
mm-hmm.
is these are national problems and they should be dealt with on a national level. But of course, we have a government now that tries to leverage these problems in order to divide us instead of figuring out solutions. Solutions don't, when you have a Republican government and their whole message has been that government is the problem, which Reagan said, you know, and they've been saying it ever since, you don't want to do anything to solve anything.
Well, as I have put it for many years, I don't know of another country where such a major, a lot of countries have multiple parties and we basically have two, but where basically 50%, close to 50% of your people in government are against government. There's nothing quite like that. You watch people argue in other countries, and it's not about whether we should try to solve these problems or not.
No, and in all these other countries in Europe, the developed world, the idea is even when you have a conservative government, they're supposed to solve problems. They're supposed to make the trains run on time.
They may have different solutions, but their goal is to solve them.
And they might have a different view of the extent of government's role in society, but there is a role for government functioning as all the people working together to address significant issues that we're all facing and things that we all want. You know, we all want clean water to come through the tap when we turn it on. We all want our homes to be powered. And when we plug something in the wall, it works. And we want our roads not to have potholes. And we want functioning police and fire departments and schools. And, you know, these are all...
And we want health care.
Yeah, and we definitely want health care. And that is a big part of the movie Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. And to me, it's shocking. And the arguments that I hear from people about why it won't work here are inane. Because it most certainly would work here. We should have national health care. There are a variety of ways to get to it. One thing that was very interesting to me in Holland is I spoke with their chief economist of their healthcare system, and he told me that their healthcare system is highly comparable to Obamacare.
I heard that that quote is in the film, and yeah. I was surprised.
It is, yeah, and because the thing is that the Dutch are very capitalist. And they like private enterprise, and they're rated higher than for entrepreneurialism than the United States.
I know a lot of people, they will fall back on entrepreneurism as the thing that America has better, and social mobility.
Yeah.
Not just better than Holland, but better than anybody. That's part of our exceptionalism. And it turns out it was true for much of our history, both social mobility and entrepreneurism. We were a world leader. No longer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was true in much of the 20th century.
Right.
We've fallen. And in social mobility, we've fallen way behind. And all of these Northern European social democracies are much more socially mobile than we are.
And just a quick note, which you make in the film, which we've made here previously, is if you have a safety net, then you have more freedom, freedom to take risks. If you graduate from college, not indebted, in amazing amounts, as we know, you cannot take risks. And a country whose young people cannot take risks is going to have a hard time being an entrepreneurial country.
Absolutely. And that's what you see here. But going back to the Obamacare comparison, I've been following the debates now with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders talking about Medicare for all, and there's so much ignorance here, you know, but I've been, because people don't understand that worldwide, the developed countries have three different ways of getting to universal
healthcare. I was going to ask this. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so one is the single payer, where the government runs healthcare, okay? And that is comparable to, let's say, the VA here, where the VA has hospitals, doctors, and they pay for all the pharmaceuticals, and they run the entire healthcare system. The next one is where you have the government single-payer insurance, where the government is running the insurance company.
So they won't necessarily run on the hospitals. They won't necessarily do that, but they are the backstop insurance.
That's
for everything.
Right. And we have that here, and it's called Medicare. And that's what Medicare does. They determine price. They set price controls, and they
insure people. Except in pharmaceuticals.
Except in pharmaceuticals, where the Republicans voted, and a lot of Democrats.
And a lot of Democrats.
To
basically, the pharmaceutical companies voted.
That's right.
to
yes.
Through their proxies. Allow Medicare to.
That's right. Which is so un-American. It's beyond belief. I don't know how that was acceptable to anybody anywhere. You know. Then the third.
And by the way, examples. So Medicare is an example here. Canada is, right? The Canada is not exactly the same system as the UK. Canada is a single-payer insurance.
That's
system.
Correct. Okay. Yes. And the third is a kind of social health insurance policy. There are names that experts assign to these that I didn't use in the movie because they wouldn't mean anything to anybody. You know, the single payer is called the beverage model after the man who invented it, but it's too complicated.
Right.
So I just called them by what they are. But the third one is essentially Obamacare, and where you have a kind of public-private partnership where you still have private insurance, but there are price controls, and the government fills in the holes to hopefully achieve 100% coverage. Now, Obamacare has been hamstrung from the beginning. Obama didn't ask for enough. I think he should have gone for something completely different in its entirety than what he did. But in the Netherlands, they're doing the same basic thing, except that they're doing it the way to make it work, because their government wanted to make it work. And our government has not, a significant part of our government has not wanted to make it work. So
that's
for
instance, where when Obamacare passed, it was sort of first draft, right? And you knew it had to be tweaked. You knew it had to be improved. However, instead, it has been battling repeal ever since. So instead of adding to it, you've been on the defensive ever. And now is it 8 or 9 years?
Well, it launched in 2014, right? I believe is the first was active. There are Republican governors denying the Medicaid expansion, which they don't even have to pay for.
Right.
And just to deny people health care, their hatred of giving people health care is so strong. So, for instance, I asked the guy who was the economist at the Ministry of Health, I said, well, and they have 14 private insurers in the Netherlands for 17 million people. And I said, well, in the U.S., CEOs of the health insurance companies are making millions. Some are making $60 million a year. You know, how do you have a system like yours and pay those people? And he said, if you have a company that accepts public money and healthcare is public money, you cannot be paid more than the prime minister. And that was it. That's how they dealt with it.
And the prime minister is somewhere under 200,000.
Yeah, it's about 160,000 euros a year. And so that's it. If you're doing this job, it's because you want to do this job. You want to help people. You know, you want to cover people. And
I mean, not to say that you wouldn't be able to buy a yacht, perhaps, if you made more than 200,000 euros. But you have a safety net. Your kids are not worried about college. You are not worried about health care. You are not worried. There's so many things. So that 200,000 allows a very good living.
Yeah, it does. When you don't have to worry about these things. Interestingly, they are starting to have a problem with college debt, and it is becoming a thing that they are now debating on how to deal with. Yeah. So in general, they let the free market operate. And then at a certain point, they see, you know, this is becoming a problem for our citizens. We have to regulate this. And then they regulate. The Dutch are very good at regulating. And it comes from a history of regulating the water flowing into their society.
That's what I was thinking. I don't even think that was mentioned in the film. But that's what I was thinking. Given their situation, that what percentage is underwater?
It's 17% of the land is reclaimed from the sea. And 27% is below sea level.
Right.
So it used to be more. They actually flooded back a big part of the country that they had reclaimed for a variety of environmental reasons. I mean, they're open to these kinds of big experiments.
But what you're saying is when you face and you actually face, that is, you acknowledge that there's that you have to contend with that problem of sea level, that problem of then you have to, it changes your mindset and you have to look for solutions. One of the things that I've often thought is that the U.S. Had so many years where there was a frontier, where we were isolated. No one could attack us and there was more land to grow and more place to move. We didn't develop that inclination to solve problems together.
Well, we actually developed the reverse inclination that you solve problems by attacking people, taking their land, enslaving people, and stealing and killing and enslaving people to get what you want. And, you know, I mean, look, I love America. I think there are a lot of amazing things here. I think we've brought a lot of super cool inventions and ingenuity to the world.
And you went to Holland twice. You made two documentaries.
Yeah.
You live in L.A.
Yeah, that's right. I live in L.A. I think L.A. is a great town. I love L.A. I love California. But loving, you know, if you love your child and you see your child become addicted to OxyContin sold to them by the Sackler family, you want to help that child. You don't say, oh, go to hell, you know, like, or I don't care because you're my child. So,
or you don't say the other thing, which is, since you're my child, it doesn't matter what you do or what you're going through, you're fine.
That's right. Yeah.
It isn't like America is always right or America is the enemy.
That's right.
America is something we love and are part of that we want to see be its best.
That's right. And so I think that we need to deal with these things and we need to confront the fact that our education system is terrible and people are only a third of the kids can read proficiently in America. We need to deal with the fact that our society is deeply racist at every level and there's deep misogyny in our society. You know, these are problems. The Dutch are dealing with these things too. You know, they're just dealing with them better than us and in different ways than we are. But, you know, they have their history of slavery. They were deeply involved in the slave trade, you know, and
they were the brokers.
They ran the ships, yeah. A lot of the ships. And during their golden age, they made a lot of money from slavery.
And that was, yeah, at the age at which Holland was at its – what had enormous power in the world. It was a land of merchants, and one of the things those merchants was dealing
– That's right.
– was slaves. We were the buyers.
That's right, yeah. And they – you know, our society developed this plantation model in the South for economic development, and that required people to work for free to make it viable. It didn't actually require it, but that's how they chose to make it work. So, but the Dutch made their money on the slave trade, and they're still dealing with that. There's racism there, and they're dealing with that. There's gender issues there, and they're dealing with that. But in general, you know, there's a high level of happiness. There's a high level of health. You know, I think I get in. Some people see the trailer for the movie because they don't go to see the actual movie, and they say, and the trailer doesn't reference the U.S. at all, but they take saying good things about another country as an attack on the U.S. because that's kind of the Republican default mode of viewing everything, and they say America's the greatest country in the world, and I say to them, by what standard is America the greatest country in the world? Because I can't think of a single thing that we are number one at anymore, except for infant mortality, we're number one. Maternal death, we're number one in the developed world. Imprisonment, we're number one. Child obesity, child poverty, we're number one. You can go down the line and we have third world level statistics on one thing after another. And while business is still doing well here, we're not even number one on GDP. So there isn't anything that we're number one on anymore.
That you'd want to be.
Yeah, that you'd want to be. That's right. Anything positive. And a lot of negative things we're number one on. And I think we need to fix those things and we need to address those things.
We're at about the halfway point, Jonathan. So let me tell people this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jonathan Blank. He's a filmmaker, writer, high-tech entrepreneur. And we're talking about his newest documentary. And actually, what we're talking about is kind of what's behind and what sort of is provoked by his newest documentary, Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. It's about the social democracy and the culture of the Netherlands. And you can learn more at Jonathan Blank, one word, jonathanblank.com, or SDB, Sex, Drugs, Bicycles, SDBmovie.com. And for this week's conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or a world that just might work. All one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. And you can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and lots of other podcast sites. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Since we've, you know, found ourselves in this comparison conversation, as I said in the intro, there are some people that would say, well, you can't compare. It's a country of 17 million. It's much more homogeneous, et cetera, et cetera. Let me skip that sort of and go to the next question, which is, why do you think America has such a hard time learning anything from anyone else? And I've talked about this many times. Michael Moore made his movie, Where to Invade Next, which does a little bit what yours does, but it picks one aspect of a number of foreign countries. And it strikes me that this is one of our deepest, deepest, most, if we were a person, this would be one of our biggest psychological problems that we cannot imagine and aren't willing to learn. And it strikes me that if you truly have the can-do spirit, which is sort of what our culture hangs its hat on, they would look around. You'd see how other people did it, and you'd adapt it and do it better. What do you think? Because obviously you've made two documentaries. You've been thinking about this. What do you think is at the root of that?
Well, an important thing to consider is that for many of these things, we don't need to model other countries because the other countries have already modeled us. And so, for instance, the soft drug, hard drug differentiation that the Dutch made. That's part of their policy. And the decision not to criminalize drugs comes from studies that were done in the United States. So we simply chose to ignore those for financial and political reasons. It worked for the Nixon administration to demonize drugs and associate them with black people and Latino people and the anti-war movement, the long hairs and so on.
By the way, I'm sure you're aware of this, but I want to throw it in. Mike Gray, the late Mike Gray, in his book about the drug war, said every drug thing was racist at some level.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
It was because the Chinese did it or because the Mexicans did it or because the blacks did it.
That's right. And that's how it's always been used. Yeah, I served on a board with Mike many years ago working on these issues. And that's one area. But one thing after another, these technologies have developed here. Other countries use them. But this country, our government's controlled by big business. So if we have things that show that you can generate wind power cheaper or solar cheaper, but the oil companies are donating and controlling politicians, those things don't happen.
Or they happen more slowly. One of the things is I think that in many, many cases, will eventually do the right thing. It's that 3 to 5 year, sometimes 20.
The war on drugs has been going on forever.
But it's that lag time where we know how to do it and we don't do it.
And when it comes to healthcare, you know, people say it won't work here. As I pointed out before, we already have the three systems of healthcare working here. Medicare has high approval rating from people in it. You know, people want to get into Medicare. And it's one of the joys of getting old in this country. So we can absolutely do it. And the arguments are very poor against why it won't work here. And the two that are repeated constantly is the size, that they're much smaller. And the other one is the homogeneity that you raised. And with regard to the size, there are no studies that I'm aware of that specifically say that social services cap out at a certain size and then they no longer work. And Medicare proves that here because it works nationwide and people are happy with it all over the country. And I don't know the total numbers, but it's tens of millions of people are in Medicare. So it's an enormous program.
I mean, the number of people in Medicare, I'm guessing, is the number of people in these other healthcare systems in smaller populated countries.
Yeah, it's more than most of them. And if you look at things like if you just are focused on size, you can look at a state like Mississippi that's fewer than 3 million people. It's one of the worst states in the country. They're at like 48th or 49th in every social welfare category there is, education, life expectancy, imprisonment, and so on, just down the line. So the fact that they're small hasn't helped them, whereas the bigger states are doing the best in this country. You know, whether it's Texas that's doing among the best of the red states, California is doing quite well on many areas, despite the fact that we have enormous challenges. And
I think we have to, I mean, we will get a deserved brickbat if we don't say that what has happened recently, however, beyond just the homeless problem, is we are now number one in poverty.
That's
and
right.
And it's because of the difference here.
That's right.
Our poor may be doing better than they are in Mississippi, but our rich are doing so much better that prices, the cost of living, the cost of rent, the cost
that's
of
right.
food, et cetera.
And the number of billionaires here, because we have a lot of billionaires. But, you know, there's Medi-Cal, there are a lot of services.
Yeah.
And there are other states that are better on average than we are, like Massachusetts.
Right.
New York is doing, you know. So the size question to me doesn't answer anything.
Yeah.
Then if you look at homogeneity, I read this book about Finland. And what was it called? The Nordic Theory of Everything, I believe is what it was called. Very interesting, well-written book by a woman who moved to Finland and then experienced it. And essentially, it was kind of like my movie, but a book version about Finland. And she just started breaking down the number of states that are whiter than Finland. And Finland is much whiter than the Netherlands. The
mm-hmm.
Netherlands is not that white anymore. You know, it's I don't want to say the number because I don't remember it, but it was most states in America are whiter than Finland. And they're not doing better than Finland. You know, so if you look it's very interesting. So the homogeneity
again. The larger states are probably the least white.
That's right.
For the most part.
Yeah.
And what we're really talking about here in some sense is that rural-urban divide.
It is, yeah. It's a big big divide that's artificially manipulated to benefit certain people, as all of the divisions in the U.S. are. So I don't think the homogeneity issue is also, and I haven't read data about that. And it's inherently racist to even say that because it's somehow implying that when you bring people together, and what you're saying is you're mixing in a country like Holland that used to be all white, pretty much, that when you mix in these other brown people, suddenly it's not going to work anymore. And so I don't buy that argument at all. And I don't think that the evidence shows that it's true. And there isn't research showing that that race changes the equation in a society in terms of the success of various social welfare policies.
One thing I will throw in, which people who've heard this show over the years, I always throw in, but it's the book, The Spirit Level.
Yes, absolutely.
In which epidemiologists looked at 30 years of research globally and found that the countries that were the most equal from top to bottom had the best outcomes across the board, health, mental health, education, et cetera, et cetera. And the countries that were the most unequal had the worst outcomes across the board that even for the rich in the U.S., a very unequal country. I mean, an outlier in terms of inequality. The rich don't do as well as the rich in, when you look at these things like health and so on. And the thing that struck me was that it's even true for innovation, that innovation goes down with the broadening inequality.
Yeah, and that's to be expected if you think about it, because you just, people become disenfranchised. They're not invested in a society in the same way, and you're not going to have the same kind of cohesion. And
you don't tap your talent pool.
That's right. Yeah, and I think that's a great book. I cite it frequently. And I spoke with, in the movie, with a guy who does a lot. He was the one American in the movie, but I wanted to speak to him because he's such an expert on what creates a good society.
He wrote The Good Society.
That's right, yeah. And I learned about him reading an article, an editorial by Paul Krugman, and he was citing him, and then I decided to go look him up. But the thing is that – and the Dutch are – they're getting a little bit more unequal – but they're still in the top 10. I think they're 10th right now. But the difference between 1 and 10 is not that big. And once you start going below 10, like once you get around, I forget where it was, but I looked at all the OECD statistics on this. When you get past 15, it really starts increasing a lot. And by the time you get down to the U.S. level, the difference between the U.S. and the Netherlands and the other countries in the top 10 is enormous.
We're talking inequality.
Inequality, yeah. And so that is, I would say that that is the biggest issue. I think also the issue of religion is a really big issue, because the best societies on earth are the least religious societies on earth. And it's a significant problem here because of the way religion is used to manipulate people and to unite them in racism or homophobia. And it divides people on issues that don't actually affect their quality of life. And in order to get them to overlook the issues on quality of life that are being negatively affected by the rich people who are manipulating them into thinking this way. You know, the evangelical movement took, which has always been here, but it took off when they desegregated the schools. And that's when the whole homeschooling thing took off. And, you know, so this, it's deeply rooted in racism. And when you have, when you have a group of people who are so easily manipulated into believing things that are not rational, and I think everybody believes things that are not rational, okay? I'm not, you know, people can have poetry in their lives. And
there are things that are probably valid and accurate that are not rational.
That's possible. I'm talking about
dreams and invention and creativity and certain things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's inspiration. You know, there's love. You know, love is not rational. We all love love, right? And the being in love is the greatest feeling. That's why all our songs are about it, right? But what's important is not making policy decisions based on that, because there's no way to judge the effectiveness. There's no way to measure what's going on. And so when it comes to policy, you have to look at what is actually working. You know, is a universal healthcare system better? Well, the U.S. is paying about 18% of GDP now. In the movie, I had last year's statistic, which was 17.2.
And I remember the one I would always say around Obamacare time was 15.
Yeah, and it just keeps going up.
Keeps
it's
going
eating up.
Up
18% of our economy. And,
yeah.
And, which
18%
is terrible.
Becomes very close to $1 out of $5.
That's right.
And it just shouldn't cost that much to be healthy.
That's right. And it's the leading cause of bankruptcy in America.
Right.
That's
one of the signal things about the difference between us and other countries is in most developed countries, perhaps all, you don't go bankrupt because of health.
All, yeah. We're the only one.
And here, it's the leading cause.
That's correct, yeah. And that's bad for capitalism. You know, a lot of these things that Republicans are in favor of, and some Democrats, and, you know, corporate-owned politicians are in favor of, are bad for capitalism. And they just lead to more accumulation of wealth by a handful of people, which is what you were talking about with the income inequality.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, you know, it's just like playing Monopoly, right? You know, in a game of Monopoly, everyone starts with the same amount, right? And which we don't do here. The social democracies try to even that out a little bit and make sure, you know, everybody has child care and education and health care. So they try to make it so that...
Right. When we talk about equality of opportunity means that some, that foundation, that what survival and a little bit of, in the Maslow scale, right, is taken care of. So now you have the opportunity to say you have an opportunity. If you don't, if you can't afford childcare, that opportunity that childcare is an obstacle for is not available.
That's right. And then as you play the game of Monopoly, you know, eventually someone has so much stuff that the game ends because no one can do anything except for the person with all the stuff. And even the person with all the stuff can't do anything because there's nothing left to buy, right? And that's where we are now in America. You know, we're just, there's nothing left for these people to buy, you know, and every time there's another downturn, they buy up more of the housing, they buy up whatever is left for them to buy, you know, because they have to put their money somewhere and they're not putting it into hiring new people. They're not putting it into educating people.
And they're not putting it into R&D.
They're not putting it into healthcare because they keep putting more and more of the healthcare costs onto their employees. Employees are now paying a higher percentage of their healthcare in employee healthcare plans than ever.
I think I read the statistic a couple of days ago. The average family cost of healthcare is now $20K.
I read that too.
$20K.
Yeah, that $20,000, and that's post-tax dollars, right? You know, so. Like, it's insane to have a system like that. And I don't, you know, and it's only because people are so manipulated with propaganda. When you see that the newspapers, if you open a newspaper and it's like one drug ad after another, if you watch 60 Minutes, it's one drug ad after another.
Right. You know, 60 Minutes is so often taking down the pharmaceutical industry in their segment, taking down, you know, this and that. And yet the ads...
That's right.
Are mostly, I think. I think percentage-wise, more than 50%.
They have an old audience.
That's right. And a reliable audience.
I don't think they take down the pharmaceutical industry that often on 60 Minutes.
Well, I've seen, it seems like there's an opioid epidemic. The distributors did this, they've been running a fair amount of this.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter. And if it really mattered, they'd probably be squeezed a little.
Yes, that's right.
You know?
That's right.
Let me go back again, because we've been in the turf here. What is it about us? In other words, we keep falling back on manipulated by propaganda, manipulated by the wealthy and the wealthy corporations. Why are we more easily manipulated? The one thing you sort of said, but I'm going to say two things. One is that as soon as you have racism as a lively, you know, big part of your culture, that makes it easier to manipulate you.
Absolutely.
And then religion, which tends to tribalize, makes it easier. Would you say those are the two keys, or is there anything else you think about why we're I think the isolation, which allowed us to not be conquered and allowed us to grow and sort of fed the positive for a couple of centuries, also somehow fed into that. But it, to me, it still puzzles me how we've had the internet now. And for, you know, what is it, 20, 30 years, people can see what's going on elsewhere. It doesn't seem to make any difference.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said. I think those are very big factors. There's also a deep strain of anti-intellectualism in the United States. And that lets people have disdain for statistics and
evidence,
information.
Science.
That's right. It allows people to vote for someone who says climate change is a Chinese hoax. You know, that you couldn't say that in any of these Northern European countries because you would then be considered a buffoon.
That's right.
You know, it's just the evidence is overwhelming. And I see people I know all the time on Facebook. They're, you know, in discussions with other people because I don't keep friends who are climate change deniers. I won't stay friends, whether on Facebook or otherwise, with racists or climate change deniers, or because the level of stupidity required to have that is, makes you someone not worthy of being my friend. You know, it's just, I don't want that in my feed. I don't want to see that kind of insanity. But here you see it all the time. And they get their news from weird psycho places that aren't reputable. And they don't even know how to think about things. So I'll give you an example. I got into, in general, I avoid like debates with people on social media because they're a waste of time. Sometimes you get into a valid debate over a useful subject and everybody learns something and that's good, but that's the minority.
Oh yeah.
And there was this guy and he said, you know, the US has the best democracy in the world, you know, and this was not, you know, this was someone who should know better. And so I said, well, no, actually, we were recently downgraded from a full democracy to a, I believe the word they use is a troubled democracy.
Something like that.
Yeah. And so he read the article that I sent him about this. And he said, well, if you look at it, the only reasonable size country that's not in that category is Germany, and they're only 80 million people. So it's because of our size. And I said to him, but we were downgraded. Did you read this? We used to be the big country that had a full functioning democracy. So you're not even able to read and analyze the data that's coming in because you're being manipulated into thinking, you know, I have to say America is the greatest, and if I don't say America is the greatest, then I'm a traitor, or I'm. He told me that I view the cup as half empty instead of half full, and I said, but you can view the cup any way you want. We've been downgraded.
Yeah,
that's the fact. And if you read the analysis of why we were downgraded, it's all based on evidence and it's rational, and you can see it around you. So people here have difficulty thinking rationally. And one of the things you see in the Netherlands when you talk to just the average person is they may not know things, but on average, they're far more rational than the average American. And so when you start presenting evidence and data to them, they find it convincing. And they might say, I'm going to look that up myself because I'm not going to take your word for it, which is a healthy attitude to have, but they understand what rational thought is and how,
and value it.
And yeah, exactly. And value.
Do you know
it.
What? I just looked at the clock. We're wrapping this up.
Oh my God.
I mean,
God.
Did that fly by,
that did.
Jonathan? So tell them when the film is screening.
Okay. There's a screening in LA at the Awareness Festival on Saturday, October 12th at 2 PM at LA Live in downtown by the Staples Center. For more information, go to sdbmovie.com or find us on social media, Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. We're all over all the social media. But Saturday, October 12th, 2 p.m. at LA Live, come see Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. I'll be there. If you have questions or you want to challenge anything I said, I'm taking all comers, so come on down and we'll have a lively conversation. It would be great to see you there.
Great. Okay, so again, the film is Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles. The websites are Jonathan Blank, Jonathan, B-L-A-N-K, Jonathan, and it's J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, B-L-A-N-K, jonathanblank.com, or SDB, Sex, Drugs, Bicycles, sdbmovie.com, or, as he said, the Sex, Drugs, Bicycles Facebook page. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. It's the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles that will flesh out our conversation, adding examples, context, and so on, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, anywhere you can find it. And you can find it just about anywhere. You can find years of podcasts. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Matt Perez in production and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. The film Sex, Drugs, and Bicycles, October 12th, 2 p.m. at LA Live at the Awareness Festival. Learn more at the sites I mentioned. Thank you, Jonathan Blank. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. Always a pleasure to talk with you. You're one of the smartest people I know. And everybody, tune in to his podcast. It's awesome. Get on his list. You'll learn a lot. And thank you so much, Terrence.